How's the State of the Union? Strong, if you ask Republicans. Lacking, according to Democrats. We'll decide who deserves the Pelosi clap on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President Trump talks both unity and defiance in his State of the Union address. What's the lasting message?
I actually thought it was somewhat ingenious the way the speechwriters and the president managed to find a way to hit themes that were so universal in their appeal and so vague that it was impossible not to applaud, and he got Democrats to applaud.
Plus, it's a waiting game in Virginia to see if Governor Ralph Northam could ride out his storm.
As soon as he admitted that he made the decision to be in the photo, every national presidential candidate called for his resignation. But it's not out of the question that Northam will simply declare himself an independent who's going to govern for the people and not either of the parties.
And Cory Booker is the latest to join the presidential field for 2020. What should we know about him?
He is the individual who wrote the criminal justice reform, got sponsors from both sides of the aisle, and managed to get President Trump to sign. He has an expertise in the kind of issues that matter to many black voters.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 263 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. President Trump finally got to deliver his State of the Union message Tuesday evening, delayed a week because of the government shutdown and some chess moves between the president and Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Members of Congress, the state of our union is strong.
In a sense, it was two speeches in one. Part of it talked about bipartisanship and comity and unity, as we had been told in advance. And there were instances that resulted in bipartisan applause. But another part was still about the need to build the wall on the southern border, making his familiar case for protecting the country from criminals and drugs. And, lest we forget, the deadline for a solution to that issue and the need to fund the government is next week. Perhaps the most interesting part of the speech was watching the reaction of Pelosi sitting in back of him, as well as the sea of women, Democratic members of the House, dressed in white in honor of the suffragettes who fought for the right to vote. Watching it up close was Jonathan Carl, the chief White House correspondent for ABC News, and he's here with his analysis. John, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hey, great to be with you, Ken.
Well, it felt like almost two different speeches, a Rodney King kind of, can't we all get together, call for unity, and then on one on immigration where the two sides remain far apart.
Yeah, and the first part sounded like Donald Trump was denouncing Trumpism. I mean, it was this come together. And by the way, it was the first part, and then it was the close where he talked about reigniting the bonds of love. I mean, this was not the Donald Trump that I've been covering for the past 2 years. But, you know, in terms of the actual message, in terms of the actual agenda, there weren't a lot of specifics. The specifics that were there were very consistent with what his message has been. I mean, the longest single section was that section on the wall. He vowed to build the wall, his very hard line on abortion. You know, with the touching on the areas that he has from the very beginning talked about where he could work with Democrats, prescription drug prices, infrastructure, not a lot of specifics on either one of those, but, you know, touching on those issues. But the bottom line is I actually thought, Ken, it was somewhat ingenious the way the speechwriters and the president managed to find a way to hit themes that were so universal in their appeal and so vague that it was impossible not to applaud, and he got Democrats to applaud.
Yeah, I was thinking, it seems like the guy or gal who wrote the first part wrote the third part as well, and somebody completely different wrote the second part.
Yeah, Stephen Miller got a hold of the second part. But of course, you know, I mean, the immigration, the hard line on immigration was there. Let's not forget, long before the president hired Stephen Miller, who came on, if I recall correctly, at about January of 2016, that was basically the Donald Trump that came down the escalator, you know, pre-Miller, pre-Bannon and all of that. But, you know, I have to say, even in that hard line part, there were a couple things missing. Well, there were three things missing, I guess. The first is no mention of Mexico paying for the wall, but I guess that went away a while ago. But there was no threat to shut the government down, and there was no declaration of a national emergency or even a suggestion that he would declare a national emergency. So even in the hardline part of the speech, you know, you saw a president, I saw anyway, I felt that this is a president that is almost desperate to get some kind of a bipartisan accomplishment before he's off to the race.
Now is the time for Congress to show the world that America is committed to ending illegal immigration and putting the ruthless coyotes, cartels, drug dealers, and human traffickers out of business. As we speak, large, organized caravans are on the march to the United States. We have just heard that Mexican cities, in order to remove the illegal immigrants from their communities, are getting trucks and buses to bring them up to our country in areas where there is little border protection. I have ordered another 3,750 troops to our southern border to prepare for this tremendous onslaught. This is a moral issue. The lawless state of our southern border is a threat to the safety, security, and financial well-being of all America. We have a moral duty to create an immigration system that protects the lives and jobs of our citizens.
Yeah, when you mentioned the possibility of declaring an emergency, well, it's clear that Republicans are not in favor of that either. Mitch McConnell has clearly said that this is not what the Republican Party stands for or wants.
Yeah, isn't that something that McConnell, you know, it's one thing, you know, for a Republican leader to go to a Republican president and kind of make that case in private, but I mean, McConnell has been explicit and very public about it. And if the president were to declare the national emergency, first of all, you would almost certainly get a very serious court challenge and probably have it knocked down in the courts. But you would also quite possibly face a resolution of the United States Senate that condemns it. I mean, it doesn't mean that he would undo it. He'd still have to go to the courts, but you would have the majority of the Senate on record, I believe, opposing the president, with a lot of Republicans joining in the votes against it.
And I think you couldn't help but watch the reaction of Nancy Pelosi throughout the whole speech. I mean, her responses, her faces couldn't have been more different than the more passive Vice President Pence, who sat right next to her.
Yeah, Pence has perfected the kind of gaze, you know, the adoring gaze of the president, no matter what's being said. And obviously Pelosi was speaking through her facial expression and her body language
and her clap. I mean, have you seen this Pelosi clap meme that's taken over social media?
Yeah, it's great. You know, that was a great moment in the speech, because the president's talking about 58% of the new jobs are women. And Pelosi immediately understands the significance, even before she knows what's coming. She immediately understands the significance. Yeah, and a lot of those jobs are right here in the chamber. And you had that block of women, House women in white, who were by and large, you know, trying to applaud as little as possible. You know, it was even in some cases hard to get up for the call to end childhood cancer. I mean, it was like they did not want to applaud this president. And Pelosi, you know, with that great, you know, clap and signaling to him, saying, "Get up! This is you! Don't you get it?"
No one has benefited more from our thriving economy than women, who have filled 58% of the newly created jobs last year. You weren't supposed to do that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. All Americans can be proud that we have more women in the workforce than ever before. Don't sit yet. You're going to like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
John, I mean, what I like about that, and you put your finger on it immediately, I don't think the women realize, as you say, the women, most of the women had no desire to stand up and applaud. And then when they realize that, wait a second, all these women who have these new jobs in 2018, that's us.
Exactly, exactly. So you had this delayed response, and Pelosi was trying to goose it from the, you know, from up in her seat, saying, come on, come on, understand what's going on here. It was really, and the president, when he says, you weren't supposed to do that, he seemed to be saying, you know, you weren't supposed to be clapping for me. He didn't get the fact they weren't. They were clapping for themselves.
But in fairness to the president, when he talked about the record number of women, he appreciated the history of the moment.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
You know, what the president said was, as you said, was warmly received by both sides. You mentioned the lowering the price of prescription drugs, fighting HIV, more money for cancer research for kids. But then he said this, which I thought was a surprise.
I am also proud to be the first president to include in my budget a plan for nationwide paid family leave so that every new parent has the chance to bond with their newborn child.
John, isn't that the opposite of what we've heard from this administration so far?
Well, I'm trying to drill down into exactly what he's talking about here, because he's saying nationwide paid family leave in his budget. So is he talking about the federal government paying for the issue of paid family leave is an issue that Ivanka Trump took on, as you remember, even during the campaign. So it has been something they've talked about, but the connection from that to his budget, that was interesting.
And I thought this was the most controversial, where he seemingly addressed the investigations into his campaign and his presidency.
An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
Wow, huh?
Yeah, and by the way, not a standing ovation from either side of the aisle for that one. And this was a section of the speech. I spoke with one of his top advisors about 50 minutes before the speech was to start, to get the last kind of rundown, what's in there, what's going on. And this advisor told me that at this point they had two versions of the speech ready to go, and it was still unclear which one he was going to do in terms of would he congratulate Nancy Pelosi on rising to the speakership for the second time? Historic accomplishment.
Which George W. Bush once did.
Yes, of course. And you would expect, you know, and the president was urged to do, the president himself was reluctant to do it, but his own top staff didn't know, you know, which way he wanted to go. And then the other thing that this top aide told me was that there was a section of the speech. I would be surprised at how much he was reaching out to Democrats and this, and how extensive this discussion of unity was. But there was one section in particular that was, you know, very much in the contrast mode, not the unity mode, that this aide had urged the president to take out. But the president loved it, wrote it himself, wanted it in there, and it was clearly that part. You could tell by the way he said the line, you could tell he loved it, and you could also tell that his own allies thought this was not a good thing to say.
Well, it reminded me of this, and this is, I'm going to play a piece of tape from, guess who?
1974.
Wow, Karnak, you knew exactly. It's President Nixon's 1974 State of the Union message, where he talked about the Watergate scandal and the investigation by the special prosecutor.
I believe that I have provided all the material that he needs to conclude his investigations and to proceed to prosecute the guilty and to clear the innocent. I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough.
Well, it turned out 1 year of Watergate wasn't enough. They needed another, you know, 8 or 9 months.
And how much more do you need for Trumpgate?
I don't know. The serious question is where do we go with the investigations? And I think that we have entered a new phase. Democrats have been waiting, and never Trumpers have been waiting desperately for the Mueller report. My view that I've been saying for a couple of weeks, I don't think that that's going to be the silver bullet for any of Trump's critics. I think that I think Mueller's been basically writing his report in public as we've, you know, through his indictments and his plea agreements. I don't think that there's some hidden thing that he's suddenly going to drop on the Congress, you know, about obstruction or conspiracy. I think that we've seen what Mueller has. So I think that's going to be a little bit of a letdown for you know, Democrats who have thought this is what's going to get Trump. But, you know, this week we had the Southern District of New York in the subpoena of the Presidential Inauguration Committee. A reminder that there are, I believe, four separate investigations coming out of the Southern District of New York into various aspects of Donald Trump. Those are going to continue. They aren't the special counsel. Mueller will close up shop. He will hand off the prosecutions that he's already started to U.S. attorneys. But, you know, this is not over. And then, of course, you have what Congress is going to do, and it's a whole new world of investigation.
Before we get to the investigation part, we still have to fund the government with the deadline of February 15th. The president talked about unity, but also didn't seem like he's giving in on the wall at all. What do you think are the prospects?
Well, I don't think he is going to go forward with a national emergency. He might, and his own top advisors have no idea which way he's ultimately going to go. But my sense is that he does not end up doing that, and I don't believe he shuts the government down, which leads to the president finding a way to declare victory even though he's lost. And I think this is a president that's capable of doing that. There is a new wall being built. It's now true. It wasn't true for the last several months that he was saying it, but it is true now as of the month of February. There's about two stretches of wall. One's about 8 miles. The other is between 4 to 6 miles of new wall where there wasn't previous fencing that is being built. That doesn't sound like a lot on a 2,000-mile border. It's not a lot, but it's enough for a great photo op. And they have been replacing, you know, old fencing with, you know, bigger barriers that look more like a real wall. I think there's enough for him to say, we've started this, we've done great with it, and, you know, go into a reelection saying, let's finish the job. He's unpredictable, as you know, Ken, but I think that he is proven time and time again that he's able to claim victories even when he doesn't have them.
John, before I let you go, what's your reaction to the Democratic response by Stacey Abrams of Georgia?
I thought it was one of the best responses that I've seen. You know, these are often a disaster, and they've ended or set back many a career. And you know, you think back to you know, as recently as Marco Rubio reaching over for his water, unfortunate moment that took him a long, long time to live down. You think of going way back to the you know, the Dole and Gingrich together responding to Clinton, almost like, you know, perfect setup for the campaign ads that would come, or even just, it's not a State of the Union response, but the response to the Oval Office address that that Schumer and Pelosi did. These things are really difficult, really hard to get right, and I thought that she had it down. I mean, it's. You know, you're never going to fully compete with the president and that chamber and the energy. But I thought that was a fascinating choice. You take a losing candidate, somebody who lost her run for governor, and you make her the voice of the Democratic Party on a very, very big and important night. And I thought she pulled it off.
Even as I am very disappointed by the president's approach to our problems, I still don't want him to fail. But we need him to tell the truth and to respect his duties and respect the extraordinary diversity that defines America. Our progress has always been found in the refuge, in the basic instinct of the American experiment, to do right by our people. And with a renewed commitment to social and economic justice, we will create a stronger America together. Because America wins by fighting for our shared values against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That is who we are. And when we do so, never wavering, the state of our union will always be strong.
I think it's fair to say that we haven't seen the last of Stacey Abrams.
Absolutely not, yeah.
Jonathan Karl is the chief White House correspondent for ABC News. John, it was great having you on the program.
Great, great talking to you, Ken.
And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't.
Last weekend, we thought that the stories that would dominate the headlines would be the run-up to the State of the Union address and the ongoing negotiations between the White House and congressional Democrats. Little did anyone expect the firestorm that erupted in Virginia and the crisis surrounding Governor Ralph Northam over a racist photo that appeared on his medical school yearbook page some 35 years ago. We'll dive into that story in just a moment, but first, we want to offer this week's trivia question. Who was the last Democratic governor who resigned his or her office because of a scandal? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
On a sailing ship to nowhere, leaving any place. If the summer changed to winter, yours is no disgrace. Yours is no disgrace. Yours is no disgrace.
There's a possibility that the political shockwaves going on today in Virginia involving Governor Ralph Northam may already be over by the time you listen to this program. In a nutshell, a racist photo that is on Northam's 1984 medical school yearbook page depicting a man in blackface and another man in a KKK robe, has suddenly threatened the career of the governor, a Democrat elected in 2017, and who has played a key role in moving the Old Dominion from purple to blue. A growing list of Democrats, including many of the party's presidential hopefuls, have called for Northam's resignation. Should he ultimately quit, he would be replaced by Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who's an African-American. But Fairfax is in some trouble as well over sexual assault allegations. So next in line would be the Attorney General, Mark Herring. But now we learn that he once appeared in blackface also. It's a fast-moving, unpredictable story, an excellent reason to have our favorite expert on Virginia politics, Bob Holdsworth, back on the program. Bob, wow, right?
Well, it's just been simply astonishing. If you think that the Virginia Democrats have been riding so high that they hold all three statewide offices, they hold the two U.S. Senate seats, the 2018 election, they flipped the congressional delegation from 7-4 Republican to 7-4 Democratic, and then beyond that in 2017, where you had the House of Delegates up, where we had 66 Republicans and 34 Democrats. The Democrats won 15 seats, and only the loss of a tie vote in which a Republican's name was picked out of a hat or picked out of a bowl prevented the Democrats from actually getting a 50-50 tie in the House. And with all the House members in Virginia and the Senate up for election in 2019, and having had a favorable redistricting opinion in a court case a few weeks ago, the Democrats thought they were going to cruise to total control of Virginia state government. And here we are, just a few days after the photo in Ralph Northam's yearbook came out of a person in blackface standing next to someone in a Ku Klux Klan hood and outfit. All three Democratic decision statewide leaders are now under some kind of cloud, and no one could have imagined this.
Well, let me start with Northam on Friday. I mean, basically, the whole thing started last Friday when this right-wing website, Big League Politics, showed Northam's yearbook page. So the governor immediately apologized for being in that photo, which he called clearly racist, though he never said if he was the guy in the blackface or the guy dressed as a Klansman. He said this:
I am deeply sorry. I cannot change the decisions I made, nor can I undo the harm my behavior caused then and today. But I accept responsibility for my past actions, and I am ready to do the hard work of regaining your trust.
But it was a complete about-face by Northam just the next day.
This was not my picture. I was not in that costume, either as black-faced or as KKK, and it's not me.
Bob, that was, a stunning reversal with less than 24 hours.
Yeah, people are still trying to understand how someone who doesn't believe on the second day he was in the portrait would apologize on day one for making the decision, as he said, to be in the photo. It makes almost no sense. And what occurred, of course, as soon as he admitted that he made the decision to be in the photo, every national presidential candidate called for his resignation. Most of the Virginia leadership was calling for his resignation. And then at the press conference the next day, while he was denying that he was in that photo, the governor did mention that he had performed in blackface with some shoe polish on his face as Michael Jackson in a dance contest.
That same year, I did participate in a dance contest in San Antonio, in which I darkened my face as part of a Michael Jackson costume. I look back now and regret that I did not understand the harmful legacy of an action like that.
Bob, that is just, and not only that, I mean, to add to everything else, he says he won the contest because he learned how to do the moonwalk. I mean, that's great, right? But I think the key is this was not 1884. This was not 1954. This was 1984.
No, I mean, that was what has been shocking about all of this, both Herring and Northam, in that Northam said, well, this was commonplace during that time. I lived in Virginia in that time. I was a young faculty member. I never saw anything like that occur. So that was what was so curious about that. And Northam seemed to struggle with that. He's an awkward politician just in general. He you know, he was a physician, not a politician, even though he was a state senator for a while. He's never been very, very comfortable as a number of other more sophisticated political figures are. And that press conference turned out to be just a disaster for him, because even if you believe that he was not in this original yearbook photo, and I take his word for that, actually, it's still hard to imagine exactly how did that photo get into the yearbook. Did he have anything to do with placing it there? And then secondly, the Michael Jackson moonwalk story just baffled people and just angered them even more. At one time, some reporter halfway jokingly said, "Can you still do the moonwalk?" And it looked as if he was about to do it before his spouse, Pam Northam, stepped in and said, "Under appropriate circumstances."
I hope you caught the irony of the chairman of the state Republican Party saying racism has no place in Virginia when he supported Corey Stewart, the pro-Confederacy Senate candidate last year.
Well, clearly I think the Republicans are just almost overjoyed by this. You know, in fact, the origins of the whole Northam issue, I believe, came when Northam had made another inartful statement about late-term abortions that was being discussed in the legislature. And while he didn't mean it, I am certain, he seemed to imply through a literal reading of his words that after a fetus is delivered, the mother and the doctor, if that fetus is having trouble, will decide whether or not they want to resuscitate. And all of a sudden, the right-wing and conservative talk show hosts basically said that, you know, Governor Northam supported infanticide. And my sense, it was that comment that actually led whoever leaked this photo eventually to big league politics to do so, the anger at what Northam had said about abortion.
But, you know, as you mentioned, it's not only the right wing that wants him gone. Tim Kaine, Mark Warner, Terry McAuliffe, Doug Wilder, Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, they all want him gone. Now, he says, as of this recording, he says he's not quitting, but how do you stand up to that?
Well, I think it's going to be a lot easier for him to stand up now that we have an allegation about Justin Fairfax, which he says is totally wrong. But we have a woman who is going to, I think, if she goes public, also is a person of tremendous distinction and accomplishment. She's accused Fairfax of a forcible sexual assault. We have the attorney general now who called
Mark Herring
for Northam's resignation. Now saying, well, he did this as well.
He appeared in blackface.
Of course, that looks entirely hypocritical. And so my sense is that Northam, his situation is looking sort of better and better every day. And beyond that, it's not out of the question that Northam will simply declare himself an independent who's going to govern for the people and not either of the parties.
Wow. Well, I mean, I don't even know where to start here, but let's put aside Fairfax, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax and Attorney General Herring for one second. But basically, it reminds me in a sense when you had all those Democrats who jumping on the Al Franken story and demanded his resignation, because if you're trying to make the point that President Trump is wrong on gender and wrong on race, I guess you need to make sure that your own house is squeaky clean.
Well, I think that's what the Democrats have been trying to do. The difficulty, of course, is that the situation ultimately turns out to be a little more complicated than that politically. Essentially, they all were there about Northam. They all basically said this both in Virginia and nationally, only then to discover that the next in line was having a problem based on an accusation about gender. And essentially what's happening there is that people are trying to think of what is the standard that you use. If the standard is that women, by and large, do not make these charges frivolously, that you have to, in some sense, not only take them seriously, but essentially believe them, then Justin Fairfax is in a lot of trouble. Now, he wants to argue that because there was no contemporaneous corroboration, apparently, at least as far as we know, the alleged victim in this instance did not tell anybody else. And so other people are saying, well, we have to wait and see how these facts come out. But to the extent that people are now wondering about Fairfax and where this situation is going to go, that has made things, I think, easier for Northam to basically say, I'm just waiting for the investigation to try to prove that it wasn't me in the photo.
Well, two things I think of right away. First of all, I noticed that Fairfax's people have been pointing their fingers at Northam, saying that even though it was the right-wing website that released this accusation, he thinks that Northam's people are doing this as, like, you know, sort of the way that Nixon wanted to make sure that, well, I can't resign because you'll get that crook Agnew as president. But if Northam does survive, as maybe these new circumstances may lead that to that possibility, that can't be good news for the Democratic Party in their quest in November to win control of both houses of the legislature.
Well, it's a catastrophe for the Democrats in every possible way, you might say, that it's going to be very difficult for them, I think, or at least much more difficult to gain the majority in both houses when you have all three statewide office holders under some kind of cloud, if it all remains there. Secondly, I think most people believe that the two major contenders for governor on the Democratic side in 2021 would be Fairfax and Herring. Now, this opens up that whole race entirely. I mean, I think what you're much more likely to see is a prominent woman within the Virginia Democrats now make a statewide run, largely because what has just happened over the last 4 or 5 days. I mean, in some ways, that might be a good thing that it opens up the primary season, but essentially, the Democrats thought that they had had some kind of secession plan, even though there was going to be a contest. They knew what it was going to be. Now everything is wide open inside the Democratic Party, and this makes it a lot more attractive for Republicans to get in that race.
Bob Holdsworth is an expert on Virginia politics. Bob, what a story, and I would rather have nobody but you to explain it to us. I really appreciate it.
You take care, Ken. Good talking with you again.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, what sitting mayor got the most primary votes in his or her bid for the presidency? The answer, John Lindsay. The mayor of New York City, by then in his second term and having switched to the Democratic Party in 1971.
I joined the Democratic Party today because it offers the best hope for a change in national direction and national leadership in the 1972 election.
Lindsay won 196,406 votes in the 1972 primaries. But he was never a factor in any of the contests and dropped out in April after a sixth-place showing in Wisconsin. And the randomly selected winner is Danny Davis of Richmond, Kentucky. Danny wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. The list of Democratic presidential candidates continues to grow. Last Friday, the first day of Black History Month, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey became the eighth candidate, more or less, to jump into the ring.
I believe that we can build a country where no one is forgotten, no one is left behind, where parents can put food on the table, where there are good-paying jobs with good benefits in every neighborhood, where our criminal justice system keeps us safe instead of shuffling more children into cages and coffins, where we see the faces of our leaders on television and feel pride, not shame. It is not a matter of can we. It's a matter of do we have the collective will, the American will. I believe we do. Together, we will channel our common pain back into our common purpose. Together, America, we will rise. I'm Cory Booker, and I'm running for president of the United States of America.
Booker is a former mayor of Newark who has been in the Senate since winning a special election in 2013. reelected in 2014 with 56% of the vote. His seat is up again in 2020. Anyone who knows Booker knows he's a high-energy, optimistic, upbeat politician who preaches unity. He loves attention and loves social media. He doesn't love President Trump, but some wonder whether he's angry enough to match the prevailing mood in the party. He's also close with Wall Street and supports charter schools, which could be a problem. Bridget Harrison is a political science professor at Montclair State University and an expert on all things New Jersey. Bridget, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken.
Well, I guess it's fair to say that the thought of Cory Booker running for president is absolutely not a surprise. I mean, it's always felt like his career was leading to this day.
Absolutely. I mean, there clearly was a kind of run, Cory, run momentum out there. Many of his supporters were demanding it, particularly on social media. And it just looked like the trajectory of his career was headed in this direction for quite some time.
Tell me, what are the strengths he brings to the office?
Well, in your introduction, you started out describing him quite well. I think that lost in the narrative, particularly since he's been a U.S. senator, is the fact that here is a very solidly middle-class black man who made his name essentially in one of the toughest cities in the United States and really came and cut his teeth on that hardscrabble world of Newark politics. The first time that he ran for mayor, it was a very racially charged campaign. His opponent was also black, who essentially argued that Booker wasn't black enough and, you know, was accused of everything from, you know, being supported by the KKK to being white. Here is someone who you cannot underestimate in terms of his ability to deal with bullies, to deal with people who are incredibly divisive, who slander him. And I think that that's a really positive attribute moving into a general election campaign. The question becomes, would he be able to get that far? And I think that he does bring some very interesting dynamics to the table in terms of black voters, which will be crucial for any Democratic nominee. Not only, obviously, is he African-American, but unlike the other African-American in the race, Kamala Harris, Booker has really made his reputation on issues that are central to many of the mobilized individuals in the black community, including issues like criminal justice reform, economic equality, school reform. And so, you know, he has an expertise in the kind of issues that matter to many black voters. And that will be important because so many of the early primary states, including states like South Carolina, have enormous numbers of black voters in that primary constituency. I think in South Carolina, it's like 71%. So these states will be really important.
You mentioned about what he stands for and what he believes in, but is there anything he could point to, like when he was mayor or even during his limited time in the Senate, as a selling point to his bid for the presidency, like, I did this or I did that?
Sure. I mean, he is essentially associated with criminal justice reform. He is the individual who wrote the criminal justice reform, got sponsors from both sides of the aisle, and managed to get President Trump to sign criminal justice reform, which changes the face of this issue, at least in an incremental way in the short term. I think when you look at, you know, his critics point to the city of Newark as it stands, not recognizing that, yes, the city of Newark has room for improvement, but also look at the transformative change that took place during his tenure and understand that that tenure occurred during the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, which we know hit cities incredibly hard. And particularly given kind of the financial services sector around which part of Newark's economy was built, that it's amazing that it kind of emerged from his tenure in the state that it did. But if you look at things like crime rates, if you look at the quality of education in schools, if you look at his leadership on environmental justice issues, I think that there are a great number of things that he can point to as being particularly important to many Democratic constituencies.
In my intro, I mentioned his upbeat personality and his optimism. Is the Democratic Party too angry for someone with his demeanor?
I think that there are members of the Democratic Party who are incredibly angry. I think that there are a great number of Democrats, particularly Democratic women, who are simply sick and tired of the divisive rhetoric, who are sick and tired of the hate, who are sick and tired of the intransigence associated with the hyperpartisanship that characterizes Washington, D.C. right now. And I think that they are looking for a politician who is willing to put ego aside and start getting to work on issues that are incredibly important to them. And we haven't seen that kind of leadership in quite some time. And I think that, you know, the rancorous rhetoric is just so problematic, particularly not just for women voters, but I think especially for women voters, that his upbeatness, his positivity. I mean, I think it's kind of funny because, you know, he's adept at attracting haters. And if you go on his Twitter feed, he's got over 4 million Twitter followers. People regularly hate on him. And his response is, you know, I love you, man. And I often think how infuriating that would be for President Trump to come up against that, to come up against someone who is unafraid of being insulted, who isn't thrown off by, you know, being subject to ridicule, but who responds in a positive way. I don't know what his response would be, and frankly, I'd like to see it.
There's been a whole bunch of articles lately about all the Democratic candidates and all their problems or all their things in their record that they would like to forget. Are the Wall Street ties that Cory Booker has, the calling for charter schools, things like that, are those big deals in a Democratic primary, do you think?
Well, I think that his opponents will attempt to make them big deals. And I think that voters will have to make that decision. You know, I think, you know, look at Wall Street. Well, you know what? New Jersey is essentially a bedroom community of Wall Street. And, you know, it would be like asking a California politician not to take money from Silicon Valley, or asking Bernie Sanders not to take money from maple syrup manufacturers. I mean, it is our industry. You know, pharmaceuticals and Wall Street, that is what the people that live in the state of New Jersey, that is how they're employed. And if you say, I'm not taking money from, you know, this industry or that, which, by the way, Booker has done, what that means is that, you know, the secretary who's making $50,000 a year at a pharmaceutical company, or who is, you know, commuting to work into Manhattan for a financial services company, can't contribute to his campaign. It's not just, you know, people envision Wall Street as being the titans, but there are people that work for these companies that sweep the floors as well. And so, you know, I think that his critics will certainly try to make hay out of that. If that's the worst that you can say about a politician in this day and age, I think that he's got a viable shot at this.
You know, we talked earlier about you watching Cory Booker's rise for some time, and the fact that the inevitable will he run for president question has been answered. Do you see him go? I mean, there's no way of knowing, and I don't want to play the horse race game this early in the conversation, but do you see him as a serious, long-lasting candidate?
Absolutely. I think that he is particularly effective. You know, what gets candidates out of the race? Typically, it is that they can no longer afford to continue their campaigns. He is adept at fundraising, including from small donors. But I also think that because he is incredibly effective on social media, he is better, in my view, than any other candidate out there except President Trump at using free media to connect directly with voters. And I think that that's really a game changer. You know, I think that moving forward, many people in the United States of America aren't familiar with his record and have a perception of what he is that may actually not be reflective of the depth and the realness of his persona. You know, they kind of have this caricature in their head. And I think that as he continues to make himself known to voters, his campaign will only strengthen in its appeal. There are many people, particularly in southern states, that I think will find his message very appealing. And I think also, given the fact that he has been asked to travel around to so many different states on behalf of his colleagues in the Senate, in the House, and running for governor, there's a recognition that there's something special going on here.
Bridget Harrison is a political science professor at Montclair State University. Bridget, it's great having you back on the program.
Thanks, Ken.
But he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He's got high apple pie in the sky hopes.
So anytime you're getting low, instead of letting go, just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt
dam. Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt dam.
Oops, there goes a billion kilowatt dam.